Good morning. Welcome to Relocalizing Vermont here on the stations of WGDR Plainfield and WGDH Hardwick. I'm Carl Etnayer.
I kind of like fallen out of the bad decision tree and I hit every branch on the way down. I landed in the thorn bush of like guilt and shame.
Well, it starts out kind of gnarly for Luke Gargiulo, but it gets better thanks to fly fishing. That's a story that we're going to hear in the final half hour of the show coming up in, just a little more than an hour from now. In the final half hour, we also have resilience thoughts and some things that are happening in our area that have at least something to do with our themes of energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil, and community resilience. In this first hour, we have a great show coming up for you. We have 2 weeks from today, the Renewable Energy Vermont Annual Conference opens up in South Burlington, and there's always a lot of exciting news happening there. We'll be doing a live broadcast from there Thursday morning, 2 weeks from now, here on Relocalizing Vermont. We're going to get a little preview of what's happening through Catherine Hamilton. She is one of the keynote speakers and thinks a lot about how to work for a larger percentage of renewable energy, including up to 100% on the electricity grid, and does advocacy for that. We'll also talk with Olivia Campbell-Anderson. She is the director of Renewable Energy Vermont. That's in the first half hour of the show. And then in the final part of this first hour, we'll be talking with Eric Loomis. His new book is A History of America in 10 Strikes. When was the first significant labor strike in the U.S.? It was during the era of Lincoln. We'll hear about that. And, write a book about strikes in U.S. history, and there's a risk that you get overtaken by events. We'll hear about more recent strikes, including the prisoner's strike of August and September this year from Eric Loomis. Well, now I'd like to welcome back to the program Olivia Campbell-Anderson, the Director of Renewable Energy Vermont. Good morning, Olivia.
Good morning, Carl. How are you?
Good, thanks. I'm excited to come to the Renewable Energy Vermont Conference this year, and you've got a number of new things happening at the conference, including you've got some public utility commissioners coming in to be there for roundtable discussions.
Yeah, well, our 2018 conference is themed Revitalized. Transform energy further, faster, together. And in our view, that means that everyone, has a role. Everyone has a responsibility. And we want to make sure that everyone's participating. We're excited to host our second conversation with the commissioners it'll be on Friday, October 19th. And we have three public utility commissioners. Our own Vermont's Margaret Cheney. We'll hear from Rhode Island PUC Commissioner Abigail Anthony, who Rhode Island's been quite advanced in grid modernization and also offshore wind recently. And then we'll also be getting a bit of a postcard from the future, but in person, Lorraine Akaba, who just finished her term on the Hawaii Public Utility Commission, will be joining us. And folks that come to the conference have a chance in advance to submit a question for the commissioners. So folks that don't know, public utility commissioners regulate utilities, particularly energy, in the states. And they set the rules often around things that, like net metering, utility investments on renewable energy solutions. So they play a really important and critical role to determining whether or not we make progress.
So Hawaii, if you look at a time zone map, Hawaii is something like, 7 time zones earlier than we are. So I think of them as living in the past. How is Hawaii living in the future?
So 3 years ago, Hawaii actually enacted or moved forward with 100% renewable electricity portfolio requirement for their utilities. There were a lot of people have been talking about the recent California effort, but Hawaii was the first state to require their utilities. They're requiring 100% renewable energy by 2045. They also have been at the forefront in terms of the amount of solar that has been deployed. They're one of the top states in terms of solar generation and distributed solar on rooftops, on homes, on buildings, and in other places. So they, in terms of a policy perspective, are a bit of ahead of other states, including our own Vermont, on managing and progressing some of these issues.
Okay. Well, it's very topical right now to talk about the role of women in science, technology, public policy. And we just had an episode of Big Picture Science on women in astronomy and physics at 7 a.m. today. We'll be rebroadcast at 7 a.m. on Saturday on this station. But you at Renewable Energy Vermont are having a luncheon about women in energy. I understand this is a follow-up on one from last year that was very popular.
Yeah, this event was standing room only last year. It really sold out, and folks are still talking about it. So you don't have to attend the conference to attend this luncheon. So if you're constrained in terms of your schedule, but we're calling it Power Circuit Women in Energy Networking Luncheon. It's on Friday, October 19th. It's from 12:30 to 2:30 in the afternoon. And, we invite folks to come for lunch, to leave inspired, connected, and empowered. And it's not only for women. You know, we have a lot of folks attending are women. It's notable that many of the executives, particularly in our utilities in Vermont, are women. But we really need to make sure that as we have a inclusive clean energy and climate economy, that we think about diversity, and particularly as women, that we think about lifting each other up and making connections in how we work, because that only, in my mind, makes us enable to move further and faster if we work together and lift each other. So for this year's Women in Energy luncheon, we are going to have TED-style type of talks. We'll be hearing from Anne Galloway, who founded Vermont Digger. You know, there are a lot of connections between women and similarities and experience in the clean energy sector in the energy sector, and also in the media sector of our community, where those are very male-dominated fields. And so we look forward to hearing from Anne as a speaker. Also, Quebec's delegate to New England, Marie-Claude Francoeur, will be serving as MC and speaking. Quebec has a new initiative called Quebec Her, and they are doing a lot to make sure that women can thrive and stay in the workplace, particularly as those who are mothers. And so I think we are still going to announce some additional speakers for that event, but definitely folks should look into joining us on Friday.
Well, renewable energy is an interesting industry in terms of attracting women. Energy and tech, as you mentioned, they tend to be male-dominated sectors. But if you look at college programs for decades that I've seen, at least in environmental studies, they have a whole lot of women in them. And you attract that sort of people to renewable energy as well. What is the gender balance in renewable energy in Vermont these days?
So we do have some employment studies that show, for example, in the solar sector, fewer than half of those employed in Vermont are women. I know that often what we see is we see fewer women when it comes to working on some of the technical aspects in terms of on-the-ground installations, engineers, and this is in the utility space and also in the clean energy sector. So I think we're making strides. I've been really inspired by one of our members, Sun Common, and they have made intentional efforts to recruit women to join their team. And it's great to see the diversity that they have within their team. You know, Sun Common is a solar battery storage and heat pump and electric vehicle provider based out of Waterbury, Vermont. And so, but I think we need every business and utility to be thinking that way as well. And so it's certainly an area for improvement. But it's really incredible that of Vermont's 19 utilities, that I think about half of them have either women as CEOs or definitely a high number of women in the C-suite leadership. Hmm. So we're making great strides, but we certainly, you know, have room for improvement.
Okay, well, thanks for that report, and I look forward to seeing you at the Renewable Energy Vermont Conference, which takes place Thursday and Friday, 2 weeks from today in South Burlington. For more information on the conference, you can go to revermont.org. Olivia Campbell-Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Carl. Rev on.
All right. I'm Carl Etner. This is Relocalizing Vermont, and we have another guest from the conference on here. Just a moment. Catherine Hamilton is going to be a keynote speaker at the conference, and we're very privileged to have her on here now at a time that's very exciting for renewable energy in Vermont, in the U.S. People are enthusiastic about it. I was just reading an article by Dave Roberts in Vox.com the other day showing that significant majorities of people in the U.S. are so enthusiastic about getting their electricity from 100% renewables that if utilities tell them, oh, that's really tough, it'll cost more, we can't really do it, don't have the technology, they don't believe them. Or they say, we'll pay more. Even if the utilities say, hey, it'll cost 30% more. Still, a majority of people say, we want to get 100% of our electricity supplied by renewables. How are we going to do that? One person who has thought a lot about that is Catherine Hamilton. She is a chair of 38 North Solutions. That's a public policy consultancy that specializes in clean energy and innovation. And she'll be speaking at the conference a week from Friday. Catherine Hamilton, welcome to the program.
Carl, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start out with, given the technological and economic possibilities right now, what's a realistic time frame for 100% renewable electricity grid in the U.S. if we push forward as a national priority? And then after we talk about that, we'll talk about various ways to achieve that.
Yeah, so it's going to really differ by region, as you can probably imagine, because there are states that are full of wind, states that have great solar resource, there are states that have public policies that have been in place for years that already have achieved 30, 40% renewables. And so part of this is you really need to set that goal. You need to say, all right, how are we going to get to that goal? And then put resources into that goal to make sure that you can use every single resource as efficiently as possible. First doing mostly energy efficiency and then looking at renewables and saying, okay, how do we get the consumer excited? And I think consumers are, as you commented, excited. Get them to be part of the solution. So have distributed resources behind the meter so that consumers really become prosumers. They're part of the solution as well as grid scale. And I think it is realistic to look at 30, 40 years from now, being able to achieve that. There will be different timelines for different states and different regions, but I think it's absolutely realistic. And I think also by setting these goals and putting policies in place that get us headed in that 100% renewable energy trajectory, you then are able to see new solutions come to bear that we can't even imagine today.
How much is new public policy needed to push us in the direction of renewable energy? We hear so much these days about how inexpensive wind has become, how inexpensive new solar has become. How much is a market just going to move us in that direction?
So realize that I work on policy constantly, so I'm like a hammer where everything looks like a nail, and I always think there's a policy solution.
Sure.
But so it has been the reason that wind and solar are really cheaper in a lot of situations than fossil fuel is because of policy, and because we've taken a position with the production tax credit and investment tax credit on the federal side, and then many state policies, renewable portfolio standards and others, that have really brought down those costs. Now, yes, there is a market angle too. So making sure that you set markets up for competition so that really everything can compete on a level footing, so that when you look at building out new infrastructure, that you're also looking at non-wires solutions, so things that don't require having to build big infrastructure, but you take everything into consideration. Keep in mind also that traditional forms of generation have long been subsidized. So just trying to balance that out a little bit will be helpful, but I definitely think there is a way with public policy from a federal standpoint, and maybe that's not right this second, but from a federal standpoint, that's important, and then states and regions, it's critical.
And while we're talking about states and regions and public policy, I'll just mention that there will be a discussion at the Renewable Energy Vermont Conference, which is timed to be this time 2 weeks from now, and that will be on the public policy of pricing carbon emissions. If you're going to pollute with carbon, you got to pay for it, and what effect that would have on our economy, what effect that would have on our energy choices. And so that will be part of the live broadcast that we're doing 2 weeks from now from the Renewable Energy Vermont Conference. Well, you know, one of the main conundrums with renewable energy is not just the price of the technology getting it deployed. It's also that the sun shines when it shines, the wind blows when it blows, and then there's less opportunity for renewable energy when it's not doing that. There are all sorts of forms of electricity storage to keep electricity resources online, even when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing so much. And if you go and look up the various potential, I mean, it's everything from compressed air, liquid air, to more conventional batteries, but huge ones, to pumping water uphill during the day and then letting it flow downhill as hydroelectricity at night. You can have rail cars with 300-ton weights in them that are moved up an inclined rail during the day, and then they go down at night, sort of like a grandfather clock or a cuckoo clock, rather. Where do you see the best potential for energy storage right now, Catherine Hamilton?
Right. So I think energy storage has a lot of different uses, and I think energy storage I see as sort of energy management. So what kinds of energy management strategies do you need? You could use smart inverters. You could use demand response. You could use advanced energy management technologies. And energy storage is part of that suite of solutions. So some energy storage is very fast-acting. Like some of the technologies with lithium ion that have hundreds of cycles, you know, and that can react very, very quickly to signals from the grid. And those are really good for managing grid stability and making sure that we have good power quality, that, you know, we can ramp, that we can address our peaks. But then there are also other forms of storage that I think are coming probably within the next 5 years, and the U.S. Department of Energy has put millions of dollars into looking at what are these long-duration solutions that also account for seasonal difference. So there is a big difference, and that you would see this in Vermont, between the winter sun and the summer sun. How do you accommodate that difference? And having technologies that are looking at with not hundreds of cycles, but tens of cycles or singles of cycles a year that would accommodate seasonal differences, I think that is not far in our future. And if you can have a combination of all these different types of chemistries and technologies and durations and uses and values, you're going to be able to manage 100% clean energy on the grid.
So, as is usually the case with questions like that, it's not a question of one silver bullet, but a lot of, as some people say, silver BBs, lots of things to choose from out there. Tell us what people are doing right now with grid-connected chemical batteries.
Yeah, so there are some technologies out there now. Most of what we've seen really grow because of the drop in cost of lithium-ion batteries are battery solutions, both grid scale and customer sited. But there are some other technologies that are flow batteries, other types of chemistries that are looking at longer duration, 4-10 hours, you know, so that they're managing the grid. There are a lot of areas, Australia being one of them, that are looking at a lot of different solutions, different types of storage, and allowing themselves to experiment. So I think where they're sited really depends on whether you can be paid for doing a service for the grid or the utility. And the second issue is, like, what is the appetite for risk that a utility or a system operator is willing to take if they don't have a lot of experience with the technology?
Hmm. Well, here in Vermont, there are homeowners that have a Tesla battery that they have bought or are renting from Green Mountain Power, or it's being financed by Green Mountain Power, and that serves as both a backup source of electricity for the grid for Green Mountain Power, so they can shave some peaks and keep electricity costs down for everyone, and also as an alternative to a gasoline or propane power or diesel power generator during power outages. Are there places, institutions that are vulnerable to power outages that are putting batteries on site, both connected to the grid so that they can help out shaving peaks and can provide backup capacity in case of a power outage?
Yes, absolutely. That is the case for a lot of corporations. There's a company in California that has been deploying energy storage at large commercial buildings, and they did it to do demand response and demand management for customers. So customers sign up for it, and you know they can reduce their costs of electricity. And in California, they have rate structures that accommodate that. However, during a heat wave in the summer, those batteries were able to be combined and managed as a virtual power plant, providing grid services to the utility and the system operator to make sure that the grid was stabilized. And I think customers, and as you're saying, homeowners, are going to start demanding this. I mean, you're looking at these events, these weather events that are happening all over the country, and I have a family member in North Carolina who had to evacuate. North Carolina, they sold out of generators, and people are going to start saying, look, it is incredibly important for me to have some way to back up because I have some loads in my house that, you know, you may not think are critical, but are, like to have your refrigerator on or a light on or be able to charge your phone so you can be in touch with your loved ones. Customers are going to start demanding this from a resilience standpoint, not just from a cost-saving standpoint, and I think utilities are going to need to start accommodating that.
Yeah, here, this time of year, we start getting freezers full of vegetables or meat that's been slaughtered from our farms or nearby farms, or we've made cider from apples and put that in the freezers. So having some backup so we can at least keep power to our freezers is terribly important during times of windstorms and ice storms. And with more extreme weather coming, it's going to be more important. Although in places like the Carolinas, other places that are threatened by floods, I guess you got to be real careful about keeping those batteries above the water level.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, the same would be true for generators. And in the case of generators, then you also need to purchase fuel and have access to the fuel. So
right.
You definitely want to make sure if you're building for resilience that you have your technology in a place where that will be maintained.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned seasonal electricity storage, which sounds even more science fiction-y than some of the things that we've been talking about. Massachusetts isn't so far from here. Tell us about Farm Energy.
Yes, Farm Energy was a company that's just been funded by both an ARPA-E grant from the Department of Energy and also through the Bill Gates Breakthrough Ventures. And they are being led by Ted Wiley, who used to run Aquion Energy, another energy storage company, and Mateo Jaramillo, who was with Tesla for a long time. And they're really looking at what is a chemistry that is cheap, non-toxic, easy to get your hands on, so there's no issue of, you know, like cobalt from the Congo. There's no issue of a resource that we can't get our hands on that's really plentiful. And how do we build like a big battery? and have it be like a power plant, and it wouldn't, it would be ready for those seasonal differences. And right now they're in Greentown Labs, they're looking at bench scale. You know, I see technologies like that as being really promising for the future, and I don't think it's all science fiction. I think in 5 years you'll start seeing those scaling, because we kind of know how to deal with storage now. This is a matter of swapping out chemicals.
So 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I would follow battery discussions in the area of, say, electric-powered bicycles, people would talk about new battery possibilities, and skeptics would say, oh, we haven't seen much development in battery technology, despite promises of something being right around the corner. You're saying these new types of batteries are right around the corner, but have we seen in the last decade enough breakthroughs in battery chemistry to think that more are to come?
Yeah, so we're lucky on the lithium ion side that we have had electric vehicles leading the charge. So a lot of those batteries have been deployed, bringing down the cost, thanks to EVs. So this is going to be, you know, a different set of technologies. I think the Department of Energy was smart in funding many different programs that are looking forward on all kinds of long-duration storage chemistries. There's no reason for me to think that that's not going to happen. We've been able to do this before. This is a very much U.S.-based technology, and I think that is certainly going to come. It depends on how long it'll take.
Okay, well, we just have another minute or so, Catherine Hamilton. Anything else you'd like to like us to know? Let's talk about distributed energy. Can you just give us a one-minute summary of why distributed energy on people's rooftops, for example, is important and what we're likely to see there?
Yeah, I think for us to really to get to 100% clean transition, we have to have everyone from not just the top down, but from the bottom up. So we need consumers really participating. And for them to participate, they want to be able to afford and install, you know, solar PV on their rooftops, a battery, smart energy, you know, inverters, energy efficiency, all of these technologies, and really be able to manage it in an easy way through, you know, whether it's on an app on your phone, but to have access to that type of control and choice, and then to be able to participate in the grid. And I think that's going to be really important to making sure that we get, because we're not going to be able to just continue to build generation. We need to be able to have consumers be part of the solution.
I like that idea of thinking about distributed energy not only as a technical resource, but also as a marketing resource and a political resource for getting people excited about renewable energy. And I've sure seen that happen. Well, Catherine Hamilton is chair of 38 North Solutions. That's a public policy consultancy that specializes in clean energy and innovation. And she is one of the keynote speakers 2 weeks from tomorrow at the Renewable Energy Vermont Conference, which takes place in South Burlington. If you're interested in finding out more about the conference, revermont.org is the place to go. Catherine Hamilton, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us today.
Thank you, and I hope to see a lot of you at the conference.
All right.